You're listening to Ian Stone's Comedy Breakfast, the podcast edition. I'm here on Love Sport Radio every weekday morning at 6:30. This morning I was joined by the former Watford and England legend, Luther Blissett. Morning, mate.
Morning.
Morning.
I finally surfaced.
You have surfaced.
Yes.
Yeah, well, we'll talk. I understand that you were possibly in hiding after the weekend, and we will...
Not after.
We will talk. We will, of course, talk about that. But, of course, we were woken this morning with the sad news that Niki Lauda died at the age of 70. We can hear, before we chat about it, let's hear a bit more about his recent health problems from our reporter, Phil Edwards.
The Austrian legend nearly died when he crashed during the German Grand Prix in 1976. He suffered horrific burns, but amazingly was back in just 6 weeks and went on to become world champion in 1977. After his racing career, Lauda ran his own airline. He had a double lung transplant last year and had recently undergone kidney dialysis.
All right, so he wasn't a well man. 70 years old. One wonders, Luther, how much of an effect that crash had on his life after that, really.
Well, it had to have a big effect on his life because, let's face it, if you have that sort of thing, I mean, I saw the pictures of when it happened. I mean, I remember I was watching the race when it happened.
It was at Nürburgring, right?
It was, yeah. And, it's just a fireball. And you think, how does anyone get out of that? And
yeah.
Then to climb back in a racing car within 6 weeks of that. And
that's
what
the amazing thing.
Unbelievable.
6 weeks after, and he finished fourth at Monza, and he only lost by a point, didn't
he? Because, James Hunt finished third. Finished third, and that point made all the difference.
And by the way, if you want to see the story of this rush, the movie is well worth watching.
It is a very good movie.
It's an excellent, excellent film. I think the interesting thing about him as well, a number of interesting things about him, he won a world title in 75, would have won in 76,
yes,
but for the fact that he crashed and James Hunt got his single solitary title. Won in 77, and then didn't win again till 1984. What went on there?
He had a break, I think. I think he went on holiday for a little while, but that is an astonishing gap, isn't it, when you think, especially in a sport that is, you talk about that is at the top of, when you talk about technical things and whatever, you know, Formula One is you know, right at the cutting edge of all of that.
He retired in, I'm looking at the, because we've got some Niki Lauda facts in front of us, he retired in 1979 to concentrate on setting up his airline, declaring that he didn't want to drive around in circles anymore. And then in 1982, he came out of retirement after a big money offer from McLaren, reportedly about $3 million a year. And he finished fifth in his first year back. And then edged out teammate Alan Prost in 1984 to win his third title. And then he retired the following year, saying he needed to spend more time with his airline business. His family, by the way, said he passed away peacefully on Monday. His unique achievements as an athlete and entrepreneur are and will remain unforgettable. His tireless zest for action, his straightforwardness and his courage remain a role model and a benchmark for all of us. Well, I mean, if the events happened as they did in that film, then he was an unbelievably courageous guy.
Ah, he was. He was an incredible man, you know. So, yeah, and he's a massive loss. I mean, when you was having that operation back in September, whatever time it was, last year.
Well, you were saying that you hadn't seen him
on
the grid.
Yeah. And they made comments on it once or twice, you know, at the races, you know, where was he? And he said, you know, he's recuperating from his operation, and didn't know it would be the last time we'd see him.
Various people involved in motor racing. McLaren did a tweet. All at McLaren are deeply saddened to learn that our friend, colleague, and 1984 Formula One world champion Niki Lauda has passed away. Niki will forever be in our hearts and enshrined in our history. And Jenson Button, a legend, has left us. Rest in peace, Niki. And Formula One, that they tweet, the sport itself. Rest in peace, Niki Lauda, forever carried in our hearts, forever immortalised in our history. The motorsport community today mourns a devastating loss of a true legend. The thoughts of everyone at Formula One are with his friends and family. Natalie Pinkham, who I believe is...
She's a reporter.
She's a reporter, isn't she?
Yeah.
Devastated to wait to the news that Niki Lauda has died, the seemingly indestructible icon of our sport. He who epitomised everything that is great about Formula One. R.I.P. Niki Lauda. You wonderful man. Yeah. He seemed like quite a difficult guy.
I think he was difficult because he knew what he wanted, and often he knew how he wanted to go about getting it. And he didn't bend very easily on things. He's very determined and very single-minded on what he went he went for. I think we saw that in the movie. It showed you that part of his character. Because he believed that was the way it should be done.
Yeah.
And, you know, 9 out of 10 times it proved to be correct.
This is Love Sport.
I wanted to have a little moan, if you like. And I'm not the only one who's doing this, but do you know what? I'm going to right now. Arsenal played Chelsea in the Europa League final. I went to the Comedy Store. They had a 40th birthday party last night. And a number of people, the first thing they said to me was, "Are you going? Are you going?" And what they mean is, am I going to Baku? Well, of course I'm not going to Baku. It's about 1,500 quid for a flight. It takes about 10 hours. And then you've got to pay for hotels. Then you've got to pay for tickets on top. If I take my son and we eat, we feel like eating when we're there.
It's a good idea.
I think so. It'll cost us the best part of $5,000. And this is a Europa League final. I mean, I would seriously think about not doing that for a Champions League final, but I'm not spending $5,000 on a Europa League final. And I'm not the only one. My Chelsea mates tell me that their allocation isn't being taken up. The Arsenal allocation has gone down to silver members. These are guys, people who don't even have season tickets. They cannot give away 6,000 tickets. The airport at Baku has only got enough capacity to handle 10,000 to 15,000 supporters. So the only people who'll be there will be maybe 7,000 or 8,000 Arsenal and Chelsea fans, and then Azerbaijanis, Karabag supporters, and whatever dignitary they can persuade to fly the whatever 2,500 miles to get to Baku for Europa League final. On top of the cost to the fans and the tiny allocation, we have a player, Henrik Mkhitaryan, who is Armenian. Now, right now, he is allowed in the country. They cannot guarantee his safety. That's the point. They can't guarantee his safety. Now, could you imagine if we flew to, I don't know, one of the Arab countries who went, "Listen, you can come along, but no Jews." Just imagine that. Yeah. Or they went to South Africa in the 70s. "Yes, but we don't want any black players." They wouldn't have the tournament. They wouldn't have the game. But apparently UEFA, who knows why, I imagine money might have changed hands in some way.
Do you think?
I think so. Whatever the repressive Azerbaijani government came up with, they decided, here's a couple of million quid. Please, can we have the final in Baku? And so there they go. Two London teams are flying all the way out to Baku when we've got a brand new Tottenham Stadium that has just opened up. We'd be happy to play there. 25,000 each to the teams, 10,000 to whatever UEFA hangers on they can find, and we have a proper Europa League final in London.
Yeah.
It's nuts. And UEFA have gone as far as to sort of apologise. So I think the team should turn around and go, "You know what, we're not going. We're not going." They have to save face, though. They fine Arsenal and Chelsea a small amount. I've been to every European final. I didn't go to the 1971, right, because I was only 7 years old. I went to 1980. I went to Brussels. Saw us got beat by Valencia. I went to the Cup Winners' Cup final in Copenhagen when we won. When we somehow beat a very, very good Parma side. Mm. I went to the Cup Winners' Cup game in Paris when we lost 9 from the halfway line, right? A lot of people remind me of that one. I've been to all the European finals. I went to the European Cup final, but I ain't going to this one. Not for this sort of money. It's outrageous, isn't it?
It is outrageous money, and I still can't believe when I heard some of the prices that they were quoting. And the Baku one also, isn't it when you fly out, you've got to actually stay there pretty much a week. You can't get back out with a number of flights.
No direct flights there and back if you want to go. I mean, some companies are hiring flights. Some supporters are hiring flights. It's about a 7-hour flight. You fly out there, you see the game, and you fly straight back on no doubt a flight with very little leg room. So you're going to spend about 16 hours on a plane for an hour and a half of football. I mean, really?
Yeah.
Why are they putting us through this?
It's wrong.
Yet again.
Yeah, but again, the football supporters, you know, we've had a conversation to this before. They have a voice, and they can actually use that voice. And that voice is, we're not going. Because if nobody turns up, they will have to rethink it.
Well, it'd be embarrassing, wouldn't it? And that's
absolutely
the point. They should be embarrassed for choosing a place like Azerbaijan, putting aside their human rights issues. And like I say, Henrik Mkhitaryan, one of our players, the only reason people aren't kicking up a massive fuss is because he's not Lacazette and Aubameyang.
Yes.
Right, and it's only a reserve. But if it was one of the main front two who couldn't go to the game,
there would have been
we're at a serious disadvantage.
Yes, of course you are. And they are culpable, UEFA, on all of this. Like they often are when things go wrong.
Like they often are. Anyway, it's a joke. I'll be watching it. Of course I will. But I'm not going. And a lot of Arsenal fans aren't going, including, by the way, there was a big piece in the Metro today. A lot of fans who go home and away and cannot afford that sort of money.
And more to the point, whether you can afford it or not, why should you have to pay that sort of money to follow your team to see them play in a final? It should not happen. You shouldn't have to do that.
Love sports.
And Andy has come in producing the show today. Morning, Andy.
Morning.
You have some stories from inside the newspapers.
Absolutely. Everything is milkshake flavour today across the newspapers, whether it's left wing or right wing. The outrage of the avalanche against the milkshaking that we've
seen. Is there outrage?
A lot of outrage.
Is there?
Because always outrage. No. Well, so Nigel Farage has complained about the sheer venom of anti-Brexit campaigners, meaning that he can't conduct normal campaign activity after a milkshake was thrown at him in Newcastle yesterday. The milkshaker was arrested at the scene.
Milkshaker, is that what we're calling it?
It's become a verb, an adjective, everything.
Yes. And this guy, it was a £5.25 milkshake from Five Guys. It was banana, which is a lot of money in Newcastle.
It's a load of money.
It's a lot of money.
Salted caramel and banana flavour.
Said
tasters at the scene.
Right. I'm sorry, were they licking Nigel Farage?
or it was just a splashback.
Yeah, okay.
But this is what you have to do as a journalist. You have to go at the centre of a story and taste the item, I suppose.
I do like the guy who threw the milkshake said, well, I was going to have the milkshake and then I saw Nigel Farage. I thought I'd throw it at him instead. He goes, I was looking forward to it. I thought it was absolutely hilarious.
Wow. Now, but hang on a minute. Look, protesters have been chucking milkshakes at politicians now. Farage has had one. Tommy Robinson's had two.
Well, he's not a politician, and Carl Benjamin is not a politician either.
Okay, whatever. People exercising their right to free speech, you know, whether you accept they're politicians or not. Phenomenon's got so bad, police have stopped McDonald's selling milkshakes in certain locations near these events.
But Burger King have said that they would still sell them. We are open for business and selling them.
But is it an assault or is it a fair right of reply?
Well,
is it acceptable for us? If you disagree with someone to chuck a milkshake
at
somebody?
No, it's not. It's not
acceptable.
It's not acceptable at
really?
All. I don't think it's acceptable to throw things at somebody just because you disagree with their point of view.
Can I give you an alternative? In 1936, Oswald Mosley, famous fascist, marched through Cable Street, and as well as chucking bricks at him as he stood through his car, they also chucked the contents of their chamber pots at him. Now, democracy survived. Democracy survived, so I don't see why it can't survive.
But it's a matter of this is. I think the problem with this is it's when it's taken too far, and there will always be this one person out there that will take it too far, and that is when you have an issue.
Well, the person who took it too far was the guy who murdered Joe Cox. Let's be clear about this, right? That's taking it too far.
Yeah,
chucking a milkshake and Nigel Farage.
Yeah, but it's only the start of these things because at the moment it's like anything. It's okay to do that. It's okay to throw a milkshake, and then milkshake would become something else. That is my problem. It escalates in time, and there'll be somebody says, "I'm just going to do this," and it's a part of the same thing because it's been made out to be okay to do that. I look at all these things on the same way that I look at things that go with racism and abuse and all that sort of thing. It all starts with something very simple, and everybody goes, "Oh, yeah, it was only that." And from that only that, it ends up being something far worse.
Would you agree, Andy, with this opinion?
Well, Farage very much looks like the victim in all of this, after all. Well, you can avidly, strongly disagree with what Nigel Farage says.
And a lot of people do.
Of course, absolutely. And the messages that he's trying to put out there. But equally, if you then suddenly make him look the victim, then isn't that what he wants? Isn't it? Michael Farage's whole shtick is that he's speaking on behalf of the common man and he's not allowed to speak. He's not allowed his opinion, which obviously is ridiculous. He's on TV all the time.
He gets on Question Time more than anyone.
But now, if we're effectively silencing him through the medium of dairy, then it becomes a big then it becomes a big problem, doesn't it? It makes him look a victim, and that
do you think semi skimmed? Do you think semi skimmed would be okay, or skimmed? Would that be better than full fat?
I just faint at the sight of all the dry cleaning. Imagine getting a milkshake out of a suit.
No, the truth
I'll
is,
tell you, it's that difficult suit is to get out as well.
That suit is ruined. There's no doubt about that. That suit is ruined. But I think it's a perfectly fair question to ask about democracy and how far moving forward. But I say, I'll take you back to 1936. They emptied the contents of their chamber pots on Oswald Mosley. It didn't go any further. Well, there was a World War.
Well, no, we had a World War three years later.
I get the point you're making, but not because of that. Not because of that. What else have you got, Andy?
Okay, this sounds like everyone's dream piece of news to me. DNA lad of the manor is the front page of the Sun. DNA test labourer, 31 years old, inherits £50 million estate from the father he never knew. Hard-up labourer Jordan Adlard Rogers has inherited a 1,500-acre country estate after a DNA test proved he's the secret son of the dead lord of the manor. This sounds like a prelude to a sitcom on BBC, doesn't it?
Yes, yeah. Jordan, it does. It would be a very good setup for a sitcom.
Jordan has now moved into Penrose Estate, estimated to be worth £50 million, wow, as the heir of aristocrat Charles Rogers. And Jordan's gone out and bought a new car, he's bought a new pair of Predator football boots, he's set up a gym on the tennis courts, etc., etc.
He hasn't gone mad.
But
how much liquid money is there, by the way? Because quite often with these estates...
You've been watching Homes Under the Hammer and Shadow in the Countryside, haven't you?
I haven't, but I know the questions to ask, but I'm just asking, in the end, quite often these estate owners... They've got property worth a fortune, but they haven't got any spare cash.
Yeah, asset
rich. Is there money as well?
Asset rich, cash poor. There does seem to be a fair bit of cash. One of the interesting stories within this story is that Jordan was doing a prank once and he broke his back jumping on a trampoline. So now he's had this terrible piece of misfortune and now another piece of misfortune. But reading between the lines of this family dynasty that he's come into.
Charles Rogers.
Yeah, it seems like he's the product of some affair or some tryst and he never met his father.
With someone from below the stairs, as they normally say.
That's right.
Some upstairs stuff going on below the stairs.
Below the stairs, yeah.
But this guy... The guy that he's inherited the money from, this Charles Rogers, sounded like he had an absolutely terrible life. He lives in this incredible 1,500-acre estate. But by the end, drug addiction had crippled him so much that he was actually living in a car on the front drive of this house. And then all of the other ghosts from the family history, where there was murders, people dying out at sea and drowning, they all haunt the estate. So it's
the aristos. They're
they're sometimes far... worse.
Well, they've got the means. They don't have to spend time working, so they can just behave badly for the whole day.
Yeah.
That's what it is. Anyway, this labourer, he's a labourer. He's got absolutely no skills at all. He's inherited...
He might have some skills. He's a labourer. A bit hard.
He's a labourer.
Well, he is a labourer.
He humps stuff about.
Talented.
Do you think?
Well, he's very good at doing pranks that break his back.
Yeah, that's how talented he is.
He might be very talented. He might play the piano or the harp. You don't know him. It's wrong to cast aspersions about people.
I'm guessing he doesn't. You know what? If you find out he plays the harp, I will apologise personally.
He can certainly learn to play the harp now in his manner.
The harp is so niche. Where did that come from? The harp.
I'm always playing the harp.
Are you? Okay. It's how you relax.
The harpist society.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, he's inherited 50 million quid, and I'm sure he'll go crazy. It sounds a little bit like, what was that guy, Michael Gardner?
The one that won £10 million 18. On a lottery all them years ago.
Mikey Carroll.
And then he blew the money, and now he's made it all back, hasn't he? Somehow. He's actually got a load of cash again.
He was all broke. He made it all back. It's hard to keep up with him.
No, he's made money again. He turned up on Breakfast TV or something talking about how he's made a load of money again. So he's doing all right. Anyway, sounds like this is him. Now, what else have you got?
Oxford University, a place where I haven't been. I don't know about you, Ian. I was never allowed in.
No.
I've been there.
You've been there. Were you let in, though? Did you have the grades to qualify?
Not to do that. Why would I get there to do that? I'm from Wilsdon, son. What's the matter with you?
Professional footballer.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
Oxford University are going to let disadvantaged students in with lower grades. Now, I'm a big believer that Oxford University is one of the pillars of education. Yeah. Should be letting in as many disadvantaged students as possible because, you know, share the wealth. We all know that those in public school backgrounds have a better start in life and they go on to do better jobs. Look at all the bods at the BBC and in politics and wherever else.
Journalism.
The tastemakers and names of our society.
True.
However, should... It's great disadvantaged students being let in. But it says, however, 50 students in the new intake, including refugees and young carers and all sorts of people, will be eligible to receive offers even if they haven't got the actual grades.
I don't agree with that at all.
That doesn't help anybody, does it? If you haven't got the grades.
If you think about the 50 students who will not get in, who do get the grades, who are being moved aside for people who don't, I think it would be good if they got the grades because it also, if they don't have the grades, it then lowers the whole student body in terms of what their abilities are, doesn't it?
So on the
other hand, there are a lot of people with disadvantages who would never get close to this sort of place. Should we not maybe redress the balance a little bit?
Yeah, but when it comes to the grades are what you get into any university or any higher learning. That's what the grades is what gets you in there. Mm. So how can they suddenly say... You don't have to. I don't understand that.
So you normally need a AAA star or at least a AAA in certain other subjects to get into Oxford University.
Right.
The university are now saying that in some cases they may start accepting ABB, which is not terrible. It's not a disaster, but if you look at A-level grades around the country, we all, you know, you get these kids on the TV opening their grades or whatever, and a lot of them get ABB, and I think I got ABB way back when.
All right.
And I certainly didn't apply for Oxford, and I suppose it is a position of, there's quite a drop between AAA star to ABB, that sort of Champions League to top of the Championship, isn't it?
Yeah, yes, I suppose that would be a reasonable analogy. I like the idea that more people get access to a top university like this.
Yeah, go with that.
But if they keep letting in people with lower grades, it won't be a top university for long.
That's right.
That's the bottom line, isn't it, really?
No, I suppose they'd argue it's only 50 people. But also, if you go there and you don't fit in and you can't do the grades...
Yeah, but that's 50, that's 50 people every year.
Yeah, quite.
Yes, that's
the point, isn't it? What I'm saying is also, it won't necessarily benefit the students either, because if they can't do the work and they don't fit in and you feel inferior enough as it is, and then inferior in the lessons as well, that's going to be a nightmare, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I think this is a good idea. I mean, we'll see. I guess the proof of the pudding is we'll see in 10 years' time whether we have more people emerging from Oxford University from disadvantaged backgrounds who then go on to be, like you say, reporters at the BBC or journalists or work in the upper echelons of the civil service.
Or politicians.
Mm. We got one more?
You've heard of Band-Aid, haven't you?
No.
Are you interested in Train-Aid? So I didn't
just ignore me. Band-Aid, Train-Aid, this is, what is this?
Train-Aid, musicians line up to help as Rod Stewart pledges 10 grand of his own cash to fellow enthusiasts after senseless destruction of enthusiasts' model railway. So these model railway fanatics had their favourite model railway section destroyed by mindless, senseless vandals.
Well,
and there's pictures of these older gentlemen looking tearful as they were, you know, holding up broken trains and broken bits of railway.
It was mindless and senseless. And Rod Stewart, who is a model railway enthusiast, stepped in with 10 grand, which obviously means nothing to him and meant everything to these guys. And I thought, good on him.
And the interesting thing is lots of other old rockers have followed suit. They were holding their guitars most of their life. Then they pick up their model trains because... Jules Holland has also pitched some money in, and Pete Waterman. So
Model railway
is a lot more rock and roll
than
we thought.
They're all from an age though when that model railway, you know, you're playing with your little train set and whatever. That was the big toy that you wanted as a kid.
My kids, who are now 21 and 17. Would not ever consider playing with a model railway. It's just not something they grew up
Maybe they're
with.
Not old enough. Maybe you get into it when you're 60.
I think you get into it when you're a kid and then you have the means and an enormous room where you can build a big model railway. Yeah. Like Rod Stewart's probably got a separate house. Oh, that's the model railway house.
One for his model wives, one for his model trains.
I like what you did there, Andy.
Perhaps in sort of 50 years, we'll have whip rounds for people having their favourite Fortnite game smashed up or
that sort of thing.
Or Mortal Kombat.
That's exactly that sort of thing. Thank you, Andy.
This is Love Sport.
3-time Formula One world champion Niki Lauda, as we've been saying, has died at the age of 70, 9 months after undergoing a lung transplant. He was badly burned in a crash in the 1976 German Grand Prix. Joining us now is Anthony Rowlandson, former editor of Formula One Racing Magazine. Morning, Anthony. I mean, it just seems to be universal sadness at the passing of Niki Lauda.
That's very fair to say, looking at social media this morning, for example. I mean, he was an absolute sort of titan of the sport, a real legend, an amazing character in so many ways, incredible fighter, brilliant driver, massively successful businessman after his racing career, and just this amazing presence who's sort of been involved with Formula One and part of the history of it and fabric of it for so long. It's just so very sad that he's gone.
Yeah, it was interesting, his attitude to life. I'm reading some of the quotes from him. From success, you learn absolutely nothing. From failure and setbacks, conclusions can be drawn. That goes for your private life as well as your career. He did seem to be, no pun intended, but driven.
Absolutely. I mean, he was a complete force of nature, I think, in so many ways. I mean, he was from quite a wealthy background. He was from a sort of Austrian banking family, rebelled against his family to go into motor racing. Couldn't get money from his dad, even though they'd been able to fund his career, sort of took out loans against himself, paid his way into Formula One, and of course came so close to death in that accident in 76. It's amazing to think that he survived at all. And then went on to win two more world championships after that, quit racing, launched an airline, And he was sort of an unstoppable man, really. He seemed someone who'd, in a way, almost like never die. He had such a presence and charisma about him. But, time caught up with him in the end, I guess.
Yeah, it did, unfortunately, because he has been missing from the racing scene for the last probably, 4 or 5 months or more. I think not long after the operation went about, being about September, October time, didn't he? When he had the lung transplant, and we haven't really seen much of him then. And, question was asked a number of times, how is he and whatever, and the thing was, he's recuperating sort of thing. So he's a massive, massive loss. And we mustn't all forget, because of what happened to him, he was a big driving force in so many changes that now we take for granted. And, we go to races now and you don't expect to see racing drivers getting killed, where once upon a time it was the norm.
Well, Anthony, I wanted to ask you about that very fact. How bad was it back then? I mean, the fact that drivers had to stop their car to pull him out, no marshal, shows how grim it was back then. I mean, how bad was it?
Yeah, it was awful. I mean, that period in the late 60s to the sort of early to mid 70s, and even into the early 80s, really, it was certainly the most dangerous time for Formula One. I mean, it's sort of, the shorthand for it is, people call them the killer years. I mean, that's a little bit sort of sensationalist in a way, but I mean, drivers were being killed all accident, stopped racing at the Nürburgring, that famous classic long 9 mile circuit in the Eifel Mountains in Germany, because it was just too inaccessible. Marshals couldn't get close enough to help a driver, actually, if they had an accident like that. And the cars were very thin, they had very little protection, they're made out of aluminium, they crumpled up in an accident, fuel tanks would explode. And, drivers were just left sitting there in a sort of ball of fire, which is exactly what happened to Niki. And he was famously rescued by a little Italian driver called Arturo Mezzario, who literally saved his life. But even then, Niki had inhaled so much smoke, his lungs started to bleed internally. He had a lot of smoke inhalation and fluid on the lungs. And that's when he was actually given the last rites in hospital. And in his autobiography, he wrote how he felt himself slipping away, but he sort of described it as sort of pulling himself out of death, because he came back that close to it and literally looked death in the eye and came back a few weeks later to finish fourth at the Italian Grand Prix. It's probably the greatest sporting comeback ever.
Well, we were talking about that very thing this morning. He also was instrumental in bringing Lewis Hamilton to Mercedes as well. That's worked out pretty well.
That's very true. I mean, he had a personal involvement in that time, because when Lewis went across to Mercedes, it was the 2012-2013 period. McLaren were still a front-running team then, and Mercedes were only just on the up. They weren't the sort of force that they've become now. And it wasn't such an obvious choice to switch from McLaren to Mercedes. But Niki Lauda's persuasive powers on Lewis, persuaded Lewis to go across, and we've seen the success that they've had since. But Nicky was absolutely instrumental in that.
That's right, yeah, because it was Michael Schumacher actually was driving for them, and they didn't seem to make any real headway while he was there. And Lewis came in, and it suddenly took a massive jump forward. So it was inspirational by Niki Lauda to get Lewis there. And he's also been very good with Lewis all that time, advising him, and you know, being that voice of reason with all the things that have gone on also.
Well, I think one of Nicky's most famous hallmarks, one of his defining characteristics, if you like, was that he was the ultimate no bullshit guy. You know, he would just give a straight answer. And because of the respect that he commanded, people tended to listen. You know, if he said jump, people tended to jump. And,
yeah.
And also, you couldn't really question his authority on racing, because he was a triple world champion. You know, he'd raced against and beaten the best. He beat Alan Prost famously by half a point for his last world championship in 1984.
And he almost died. Yeah. And I think that gives you a certain authority in the car. We'll leave it there. Yeah. Thank you, Anthony. Nice to speak to you. And to Anthony Rowlandson, former editor of Formula One Racing magazine. We're talking to him, as is on the day that Niki Lauda died, age 70. Remarkable three-time world champion, and almost died in the 1976 German Grand Prix, back 6 weeks later in the car. So, as he said, finished fourth at Monza.
This is Love Sport.
Guy Watts has come in as well. Guy, they're currently putting up pictures of cricketers. Have you got it?
Yeah, I know who's in the squad.
You know who's
I do.
In the squad.
Yeah.
Well, tell us who's in the squad then, Guy.
Jofra Archer's in the squad.
Yes.
In the least surprising development since...
Something
else that was not surprising.
Not since Man City won three trophies.
Or like even Steve Clarke, because I think a lot of people felt he was going to get that job.
I'm surprised that Steve Clarke's in the England cricket squad. I've got to be honest with you. But
We wish Jofra the best of luck up in Scotland, don't we?
Well, yeah. Quite.
It's a tough crowd to please.
But he's in the squad of who?
David Willey has been left out. As we expected this morning, as per the papers, all that sort of thing, as per the speculation. Joe Denley as well is another omission from the original 50-man preliminary squad.
Liam Dawson's in.
So a left-arm spinning option. Let's be honest, a kind of more of a bowler than Joe Denley, to be quite plain about it. Joe Denley was a batsman who became in his 30s a pretty decent white ball leg spinner.
We have enough batting, don't we?
I think we do. So James Vince is also confirmed as being in. That was one of the other least well kept secrets, that he was going to replace Alex Hales.
Yes.
And it is ultimately an extremely strong looking squad. It's one of those that you know, if it were a different sport, it would be the Argentinian football squad or the New Zealand rugby squad. It would be the one you'd look at and go, on paper, that is going to be an extremely difficult squad to beat.
Just to name them, Owen Morgan, Moeen Ali, Jofra Archer, Johnny Bairstow, Joss Butler, Joe Root, Adil Rashid, Liam Plunkett, Liam Dawson, Tom Curran, Jason Roy, Ben Stokes, James Vince, Chris Wokes and Mark Wood. And out of those 15, who are you starting with?
All right, well, I'll say who I'll leave out, because that'll be quicker. Liam Dawson, obviously, is the backup spinner.
Yeah.
And it will depend very slightly pitch to pitch, ground to ground. Adil Rashid, for example, we heard Steve James in the Times arguing earlier that he is our most important player, but we saw him left out at Bristol the other day, not just because he was being rested, but because the boundaries are so short. If we were to play there, he might not make the team. But I think our generally speaking strongest 11 would not have Tom Curran. It would not have Liam Plunkett, it would not have Liam Dawson, and it would not have James Vince. It would give us a pace bowling attack of Mark Wood, Jofra Archer, Chris Wokes and Ben Stokes as the fourth seamer, with Moeen Ali and Adil Rashid as the two spinners. It would be a top six of Johnny Bairstow, Jason Roy, Joe Root, Owen Morgan, Joss Butler and Ben Stokes, with Moeen Ali batting seven and the bowlers after him.
Unbelievable batting in that
Unbelievable.
Team. I mean, it's a great team, actually, and if Jofra Archer works out to be as good at he seems to be as good as we thought he was on those three balls he bowled in that rain-affected game, we have got a serious... This is a World Cup winning team.
Exactly. And, you know, we've been deliberating all morning, all week, all month almost about who's going to make it, who's going to not. It's probably not... They're probably not calls that are going to decide the World Cup.
No.
A, it's about the squad members. And B, if they do get a game, it'll probably be when we're either resting people or doing a little bit of rotation. But you know what? That team I just named, you could take out a couple of those guys. And if you're bringing in, for example, Tom Curran, he's playing as well as he ever has. And you know what? He's a very handy batsman as well as a good death bowler. We've got Liam Plunkett, who's got more wickets in the middle over. overs in One Day Internationals than any other bowler since the last World Cup. Yeah. We got a fantastic batsman in James Vince. He made 190 the other week in a game for Hampshire. And in Liam Dawson, you've got a very good all-rounder who's also been playing well for Hampshire. Okay, he's maybe not a household name. He's not a star, but I think he would do a very solid job if called upon for a game or two.
And if you think about back to, I think it was the third, maybe the fourth One Day International when England, without Jos Buttler in the team, scored about 370 or 380. And I don't think Johnny Bairstow got many in that game either.
You're quite right.
So, you know, it's there's scary. A lot of batting.
Let's be honest. We're not being jingoistic. We're not being biased, blinkered, any word you want to use when we say that we're the clear favourites, that our preparations couldn't have gone better to have played six games in the English summer so far and won them all, even with a weakened team in tough conditions over in Ireland or with lots of choppy and changing, people not getting runs in the team. We've looked really, really good. And Pakistan, by the way, are no mugs at all. They've got serious batsmen, quick bowlers, and okay, they were missing Shadab Khan, their main spinner, but ultimately they were still a good team, and if we came up against them in a World Cup semi-final, that would give us extreme confidence, you'd like to think, going into it, although they did, of course, beat us in the Champions Trophy semi-final 2 years ago. Let's hope that doesn't happen again. But
Tough start, though. South Africa is not an easy start, is it? I mean, they are one of the teams that could win the trophy.
Yeah, they are, although they never have, just like us. They have possibly got an even bigger reputation for bottling it, if you like, in cricketing terms, than England do. I would argue personally, I'd rather start against a strong team like a South Africa or Australia, whoever you want to name, than a weak team. A, I think it gets you up to tournament speed a bit more quickly. And B, it removes the possibility of the embarrassing start. You know, if you lose to Bangladesh or someone like that in the opening game, it's panic stations. It's what do you do? Where do we go from here? And it removes that possibility. Lose South Africa, no shame in that. Not ideal, but no shame. And
there's quite a lot of group games as well, aren't there?
Well, it's a round robin, so it's nine group games. All 10 teams play each other once. Yeah. So you've got plenty of time in theory to get up to speed. You don't want to take too long, but you could lose a couple of games at the start and still get up to speed in time. And
then it's semi-finalists and finalists.
Quite right.
So you need to be in the top four, basically. Yes. Yeah, sorry. That was
a traditional semi-final layout.
How many in the semi-final again?
You're mentally working that one out.
Yeah, okay. Oh, yeah. Okay, fair enough. Well, looking at this team, very excited at their prospects. World Cup starts on the 30th of May.
Thursday.
South Africa. Where's that game being played?
At the Oval, just down the road.
The Oval.
How exciting.
Are you going?
I'll be working here. Unfortunately,
I'm sorry, guys.
You can nip off though. It's a 10:30 start, so you could probably be there for the first ball.
Okay, if there's a ticket going, I'm happy. I might actually pop along.
0208 70 20 558. If you've got one,
please, I'd like to be taken. Thank you very much, Guy. It's Guy Watts there with the news of the England squad for the World Cup starts the 30th of May at the Oval against South Africa.
This is Love Sport.
We are approaching the summer with transfer rumours whirling around players at standoffs with clubs and agents on the lookout for the next potential move for their clients. Joining us now is the football agent and former professional footballer Barry Siltman. Good morning, Barry.
Good morning, guys.
Silky, how are you?
Good, Luther. How are you, mate?
I'm very good, sir. I'll be very interested to hear what you've got to say about some of this, mate.
Well, look, Barry, we'll start asking. I mean, this is obviously the time of year when agents start earning their money. I mean, let's talk about Gareth Bale, first of all. How do you see that situation?
Well, obviously he's not getting a regular game, which everyone can see. His agent is, I think it's Jonathan Barnett.
Yes.
Bill Stella. And if the player moves, I mean, if he moves, obviously he's not going to get the salary that he's on now. And the only scenario that I can see playing out is, A, he's got to take a drop in salary, and B, if Real Madrid want him to go, they're going to have to pay him some money to go. And I think if he leaves, it's not going to be easy to leave there. I mean, what club do you go to after Real Madrid? And the fact is, over here, who can pay him what I would say would be a fantastic salary? Because whatever happens, he's not going to go for £100,000 a week somewhere.
He's going to want a lot more.
So you're very limited where you can go. But also at the same time, I think the player's got to look and say, well, you know what? I need to play football. I mean, Luther would tell you, we've been in the same position. There comes a stage in your career, you say, I need to play. I can't sit on the bench and become a bit part player because, let's be fair, he's still a fabulous player.
So you don't believe him? So, Barry, this is the point. You don't believe those reports that are saying that he has apparently said to his teammates, they pay me 17 million euros a year for 3 years, otherwise I could just play golf for the next 3 years?
No.
No. All he's doing with that, Barry, I suppose, is just making his position known, is that if you want me to go, you're going to have to part with some money, or you're going to have to make some sort of deal that can get this done so I don't lose out, because you're the one that wants me to move.
That's what's going to happen. He wants to play football. You know, we've got to be very frank here that there's very few footballers that are around today that are willing to sit there. And if ever, I don't know too many footballers that are willing to just say, do you know what, I'm going to take the money and I don't care if I don't play. They want to play. But at the same time, what they're going to say is, well, look, you want me to go, you're going to have to pay me to go. That's really the bottom line.
I mean, there's some other possible big moves. Garrett, we're talking about Alexis Sanchez, but they may not want to get him out because it really has upset their wage structure. And Paul Pogba's another one. But like you say, these are guys who would expect, and their agents would expect them to earn similar money elsewhere, but they won't get it, will they?
No. I mean, Alexis Sanchez was a one-off. He was terrific at Arsenal. Now, or whether it's the style of football at Man United, whether he's playing with different type of players. I mean, when he was at Arsenal, he played very much as a loose player. And when he went to Man United, I mean, his salary is huge. In fact, it's not exactly as it seems. I know what his salary is. I know how he's paid. I know the whole deal. But he is on incredible money. And again, there is no way he's going to go to a club unless he goes to China. If he goes to China, he will get what he's earning now.
But if he goes to Serie A, because there's been AC Milan and who else has been sort of rumoured to have shown some interest in him. So you're thinking that move probably will not happen?
No, if he goes to Serie A. If you look at a club like Juventus, their top salary is roughly, give or take, 25% of what he's earning. That's their top salary.
So
I'm not sure in Serie A anyone can pay him. The only scenario, and it is the only scenario, is if the club's willing to pay a huge transfer fee, let's say somewhere in the region of 20, 25, 30 million euro, and he gets an enormous amount of that back to leave. Again, very similar to Gareth Bale.
Yeah.
We're not going to get the same salary, but if we get a transfer fee and we pay you 75% of that transfer fee back, because do you remember they got him on a free transfer?
Yes.
So, you know, if they go and get 25 million euro and they give it to him back, yes, they've lost the salary that they paid him, but in effect, they're not out of pocket, if that makes any sense.
Oh, it does make a lot of sense. I mean, what they've got to be is really, they've got to be creative if they're going to get these deals across the line.
Correct.
And get them done.
Correct.
But
yeah,
Barry, 100%. Barry, don't, I mean, I know how you're going to answer. I have a feeling I know what your answer is going to be. But don't agents, to a certain extent, get in the way sometimes? If you think about some of the bigger fees that some of the super agents take, Mino Raiola and what have you, and that seems, if that money was a bit more sensible, perhaps the players could get a bit more. Perhaps they could. It would be easier to engineer a move.
Yeah, look, there are some agents that do get phenomenal money. I mean, we've got to be fair, they do get amazing money. But there is, at the minute, a little bit of a clampdown where a lot of clubs are saying to the agents, right, you get 10%, which in fact is, it works out half of what a showbiz agent would get.
Yeah.
But they just say, you get 10% and that's all you get. Now, if the agent has already earned his money and he's not an agent that's come along, let's say, he's a new agent of a player. So the player's got rid of his old agent and he's got a new agent in. If the agent is still the same agent, which in 90% of the cases it is, they've already earned their money. So for me, whatever they earn now is a bonus, because when you get paid by a club, it's very rarely that you get all the money up front.
Yeah.
But sometimes you do. Yeah. And if you get the money up front and that player, let's say, has signed a 5-year contract, and 2 years down the line, he's going to go, or 1 year or 3 years, whatever it is, you've already had your money for that 5 years. So if when he moves, as an agent, you're not losing anything. And you've also got to look at your client. I mean, it's a little bit different for me because I was a footballer.
Yeah.
So I don't, when I do a deal, I've never, ever come from a financial side. I've always come from a football side because that's just what's in my head. So I'll speak to the player what I think is right for him, whether the player then takes it on board. But I wouldn't stand in the way. I'd be happy to get my 5% or 10% if the player's happy, because I've already earned my money. So in the case of Mina, I mean, if Mina's earned his money out of a deal and he's earned his money that's really based over 5-year contract, but he's had all of it within a year or 2 years, I'm sure that he's not going to stand in the way because he's had his money.
Yeah.
So, you know, they are sensible. There's a lot of stories that go in the newspapers that really aren't true about agents' money, but there's a lot that are true.
Don't get
me wrong, but not every deal you're getting fortunes. Believe me, there's a lot of, I've done a lot of deals where people have thought I've had fortunes and I've had 5%. And if the player's left the club after 2 or 3 years, that's it. That's the end of the month.
Yeah.
You know, and 5% after you pay tax ends up under 3%.
Barry, I'll get the comedians to organise a benefit gig for you just to keep you going, OK?
I'm all right there. Only as long as Bliss comes and plays. Okay.
Nice to speak to you, Barry.
Thanks,
Thank you. Barry Siltman there, football agent. He's scraping by on very, very little.
It's difficult for
him. I'm getting there. Yeah. I am getting there. This is
Love Sport.
And Andy has come in.
Oh, well, there's online on various websites at the moment. You may well see Pep dancing like an enthusiastic backing singer at the Eurovision.
Yes.
And it's an incredible sight because they had this official ceremony, official awards due. Pep Guardiola in his suit, jacket off, really going some. He's got some real moves, a lot of fist bumping, a bit of a disco wiggle. And it's very enjoyable to watch, even if you're not a Man City fan.
He can dance, why not? He's got some rhythm about
him. He's got reason to dance.
You know, he has, and he's celebrating. There's no reason. I don't have a problem.
You'd never get Fergie doing that, though, would you?
I can't imagine Fergie does. Can you imagine Sam Allardyce dancing?
No.
He would do.
Do you want to imagine it?
He would do the bump. Do you remember the bump?
Yes.
Let's all take a moment to imagine Sam Allardyce doing the bump. What have you got, Guy? Guy's coming as well.
I think there's a nice segue there, actually, to the story I wanted to do, potentially for us to finish on. I Want to Dance with Somebody is what you might have sung along once upon a time to at a Whitney Houston concert. Am I right? I haven't got her mixed up with someone else, have I?
I thought she had a lovely voice, Whitney Houston.
Great, Whitney.
And she was great, and it was tragic the way it went. I was never a huge fan of her.
All right, fair enough.
You're right, that is a Whitney song.
There were a lot of people who were big fans. And the news you might have missed today is that there is, in fact, although she is no longer with us in person, there might yet be a Whitney Houston tour. And
by hologram.
She's going to be there as a hologram. What do we make of this? Apparently the technology is being developed and it is now better than ever, as most technology is. And other stars, including Roy Orbison and Frank Zappa, have made holographic comebacks. Is that something that you can imagine working if you were a devoted fan of one of these artists and you had sadly lost them if you thought too young or just at any stage, you thought, actually, yeah, I'd be well up for seeing them as a hologram. Is that
surely
the same?
You just buy the DVD, though, wouldn't you?
It would have to be something quite intimate if you were going to do that, though, wouldn't you? I think in a huge arena, I mean, that surely is not going to work, is it?
These holograms are pretty amazing. I mean, if you actually, because you asked me earlier and I was thinking about who would I like to see who's no longer with us, Aretha Franklin, I would go and see a hologram version of her, and I would go and see a hologram version of Ian Dury and the Blockheads.
Really? There you do.
Tomorrow. What happened was I saw What a Waste. Do you know the song?
No.
Oh, it's an absolutely fantastic. Ian Dury and the Blockheads were great, and What a Waste is one of their greatest songs, poetry, and a brilliant band. and I was, and he's one of the few that I didn't get to see back in the day, and I was a bit gutted, and I'd love to see him. What about you, Luther? Anyone you fancy? Caruso? I'd like to see Caruso. You missed him when he first came round.
I did. Yeah,
we all missed Caruso.
But surely you could play 100 gigs at once if you're a hologram.
Well, you could have
Whitney busking in every city centre of the country simultaneously.
Yes, you could, but you could probably make a bit of money if you had a hologram of Whitney doing a big gig, because I guess they film them, and you just play it as a hologram. And if the hologram's good enough, I'm sure it'd be pretty cool to be there, because you could still have a live band, by the way, couldn't you?
They could throw roses at her and let it go straight through her.
That would be a bit weird, but you could still have the live band,
I think it would work, because I think, isn't the point, obviously, part of it is about the actual performing of the live music, but if you are there, if you're kind of in the atmosphere of it, and someone is appearing to be there, singing the songs, making the sounds, that's all it's about, sound, right?
It is.
If they're making the sounds that you know and love, and you're there with friends, you're there with a load of other people, thousands of people that all want to do the same thing.
Live music, Queen have done it. Queen have played gigs where Adam Lambert has not been performed one song, and they've played a video of Freddie performing the song. And everyone's just happy to be there.
Yeah, exactly.
And there is nothing like live music. So, you know what? Obviously, we'd rather the artists were alive, but in some cases, there's very little we can do. And so, I quite like the idea.
This is Love Sport.
Thanks for listening to the Ian Stone Comedy Breakfast Podcast Edition. I'm back every weekday morning, 6:30.